The lawyer mentions that you have date nights with your daughter, that she gets dressed up in an adult-like fashion and that the two of you go out to romantic destinations. So? Russ, Taglieri gave me a pained look. It's disgusting, but the lawyer is suggesting that your relationship with London might be unhealthy, if not outright inappropriate. It took me a second to grasp the implication. When it hit, it took my breath away. Oh, God. Vivian wouldn't do this. Not in a million years would she do something like this. I actually felt lightheaded, black spots swimming at the edge of my vision. I was mortified, repulsed, and furious, but even those terms weren't strong enough to describe the way I was feeling. It was only innuendo, Taglieri cautioned, but the fact that it was mentioned in the letter at all troubles me. At the very least, it signals that they're prepared to paint a very negative, if not downright sickening, picture of you. I barely processed Taglieri's words. Vivian wouldn't do this. How could she even hint at something like this? I'm going to get on the phone with the attorney later because we can't just ignore these kinds of implied threats. It's an attempt to intimidate you, and it's also incredibly unprofessional. At the same time, it gives us a sense of just how far Vivian might go to get custody. And if it goes to court, I want to emphasize that you never know what a judge is going to decide. What do I do? I know London wants to live with me. Like I said, let me talk to the attorney. But what would be best, as I told you early on, is for you and Vivian to work it out. Because as your attorney, I can't say I feel optimistic about your chances when it comes to winning this thing. For the rest of the day, I staggered around as if I'd received a massive body blow. I didn't go to work. I didn't go home. I didn't visit Marge or Liz or drop by my parents' place. In my speechless fury, in my horror, I didn't want to talk to anyone. Instead, I texted Emily and asked if she could pick London up from school and watch her until I got back into town. She asked me where I was and what was wrong, but I couldn't answer. I need a few hours alone, I texted back. Thank you. Then, getting into my car, I started to drive. 3.5 hours later, I was in Wrightsville Beach, where I parked my car. The sky was overcast and the wind was bitter. I walked the beach longer than it took me to make the drive. And as I walked, my mind circled from London to Marge to Vivian before starting anew. With it came uncertainty and fear and relentless waves of emotion. I alternated between rage and confusion, heartbreak and terror. And by the time I returned to the car, my cheeks were windburned and my soul was numb. I hadn't eaten all day, yet I wasn't hungry in the slightest. I made the drive back to Charlotte and picked up London long after the sky had turned black. It was past London's bedtime, but thankfully Emily had fed her. I couldn't summon the energy to speak to Emily about what had happened just yet. There was so much I still didn't know how to put into words. It was Marge to whom I eventually turned, mainly because she left me no other choice. It was the last Friday in January, and I had agreed to stay with Marge while my mom ran to the pharmacy to refill one of Marge's prescriptions. By this time, the cancer had progressed to the point where no one was comfortable leaving Marge alone, even for a little while. The living room was illuminated by a single table lamp, and the shades had been drawn at Marge's request. She said bright light made her eyes ache, but I knew the truth. She didn't want us to see her clearly, for even a single glance was enough to reveal how sick she really was. So much of Marge's hair had fallen out that she'd taken to wearing an Atlanta Braves baseball cap whenever she was awake. Even though she was wrapped in a blanket, her continued weight loss was evident in her bony hands and painfully skinny neck, in which her Adam's apple protruded, knob-like. Her breathing sounded wet and thick, and she had long bouts of coughing and gagging that sent my mom and Liz into a panic. They would pound her back in an effort to dislodge mucus and phlegm, which often came out bloody. She slept more than 16 hours a day, and her appearance at the open house 2 weeks earlier was the last time she'd left the house. She could no longer walk more than a few steps on her own. The cancer in her brain had affected the right side of her body, as if she'd had a stroke. Her right arm and leg were weak, and her eye had begun to droop. She could only offer half smiles. And yet, as I sat beside her, I found her as beautiful as ever. "Emily came by yesterday," she said, the words emerging slowly and with effort. I like her so much, Russ, and she truly cares about you. You need to call her, she said with a pointed look. You have to talk to her. Let her know what's going on with you. She's worried about you. Why did she come by? Because I asked to see her. I wanted to spend some time with the woman my brother loves. The new and improved model, I mean. She forced a weak smile. That's what I called her. I think she was pleased. I smiled. Despite her decline, Marge was still Marge. She gathered her strength for a moment and went on. I think it's time that I talk to London, too. When? Can you bring her by this weekend? She won't be here. She'll be in Atlanta with Vivian. Then how about after school today? My sister, in her own way, was telling me that time was running out. I was suddenly unable to swallow. All right, I whispered. I want to see Vivian, too. Can you set that up? My stomach tightened at the name and I looked away. Still furious and mortified, I could barely tolerate the thought of Vivian, let alone the idea of asking her to visit my dying sister. Marge saw my expression but pressed on. I need you to do this for me, she said. Please. I'll text her, I said. But I don't know whether she'll come. She's usually on a tight schedule. See what she says, Marge pressed. She blinked, and I noticed that even her lids were slowing down. Tell her it's important to me. I reached for my phone and texted Vivian. She responded almost instantly. Of course, the text said. Tell Marge I'll be there around 5. I let Marge know and watched as she closed her eyes. I thought she was about to fall asleep before she opened them again. Have you accepted the offer on your house yet? I shook my head. We're still going back and forth on the price a bit. That's taking a long time. The potential buyers have been traveling. According to my realtor, we're close, though. She's thinking we'll sign next week. That's good, right? So you'll be able to pay off Vivian? Again, the sound of her name made me recoil. I guess. Marge stared at me. Do you want to tell me what happened? Emily said that you were gone all day Wednesday, but wouldn't talk to her about it. Rising from the couch, I peeked out the window to make sure my mom wasn't pulling into the drive. I didn't want her to hear what was going on. The last thing she needed was even more stress in her life. Taking a seat again, I brought my hands together and told her about the meeting with Taglieri and the letter that Vivian's attorney had sent. Well, Marge said when I finished, this isn't completely unexpected. She's been very clear all along that she intends to bring London to Atlanta. But the threat, she's playing so dirty. What does your attorney say? That he doesn't like my chances, and that he still thinks Vivian and I should work something out between us. Marge was silent for a moment, but her gaze was almost feverish in its intensity. First, you have to know what you really want. I frowned. Why do you keep saying that? We've talked about this already. I've told you what I want. Then do what you have to do. You mean go to court? Play dirty like she is? She shook her head. I don't think that would be good for London, and London is your priority. Then what are you suggesting? I think you know, she said, closing her eyes again. And as I studied her weary face, it finally dawned on me that I actually did. On the way back from Marge's, I called Emily, asking if we could meet for lunch. She agreed, and we arranged to meet at a bistro not far from her home. First, I want to apologize for not telling you what was going on, I said as soon as we sat down. To be honest, I didn't even know how to begin. It's okay, Russ, she said. Sometimes we all need to process things on our own first. Don't ever feel pressured by me. I'm here whenever you feel ready to talk, or even if you don't. No, I'm ready now, I said, touching her hand. Taking a deep breath, I told her everything. About London's distress, my instructions to Taglieri, and Vivian's response. As I spoke, she brought her hands to her mouth. I can't imagine how you must have been feeling, she said when I finished. I would have been shell-shocked and completely, utterly furious. I was. I still am, I admitted. For the first time, I feel like I actually hate her. With good reason, she said. Maybe it's not such a bad idea to let the psychologist talk to London. You'll probably be able to put these crazy allegations to rest right off the bat. There's still the issue of the bicycle accident. Kids have accidents, Russ. That's why the law requires them to wear bicycle helmets. Judges know that. I don't want this custody battle to play out in court. I don't even want London to have to meet with a psychologist about this. If she needs counseling to help her deal with a divorce, that's different. But I'm not going to put London in the position of having to choose between her mom and dad. I shook my head. I'm trying to stay focused on what's best for London, and I know she needs me in her life as a consistent, everyday presence, not in an occasional, ad hoc way. So I'm going to do what I have to do. I knew I was being vague, but there were some things I just couldn't tell Emily. She nodded before sliding her water glass toward her. Rather than raising it to her lips, however, she rotated it on the table. I saw Marge yesterday, she said. I know, she told me. How do you like being labeled the new and improved model? I cracked a grin. I'm honored. Then with a sad smile, she's such a good person. The best. There was nothing else really to say. After school, I brought London to Marge's. Because she'd been to the house numerous times in the past month, she'd known that Marge was sick, even if she didn't realize the seriousness of her illness. When Marge opened her arms, she went to her as usual and gave her a tender hug. When I mouthed the question, "Do you want me to stay?" Marge shook her head. "I'm going to visit with Nana for a little while, okay, London? Will you keep an eye on Auntie Marge for us?" "Okay," she said, and I left them alone in the living room. My mom and I sat on the back porch off the kitchen, not saying much of anything. A short while later, when I saw London enter the kitchen, I went back inside and held her as she cried.
"Why doesn't God make Auntie Marge better?"
she choked out. I swallowed through the lump in my throat, squeezing her small body to mine. "I don't know, sweetie," I said. "I really don't know." Vivian texted that she planned to go straight to Marge's after her flight landed, and as a result, she didn't arrive at the house until 6:30. As soon as I saw the limo out front, I thought of the letter from her attorney. I left the front door open but retreated to the kitchen, feeling a wave of disgust toward her wash over me. Even though she'd just spent more than an hour with my sister, I still had no desire to speak to her. I heard Vivian enter the house and then London's tremulous voice, asking Vivian if she really had to go to Atlanta. Despite Vivian's promise that they were going to have a terrific time, London began to cry. Footsteps pounded as she ran to the kitchen and threw herself into my arms.
"I don't want to go, Daddy," she sobbed. "I want to stay here. I want to see Auntie Marge."
I scooped her up and held her as Vivian entered the kitchen. Her expression was unreadable. "You need to spend time with your mom," I said. "She misses you all the time, and she loves you very much." London continued to whimper.
"Will you take care of Auntie Marge while I'm gone?"
"Of course I will," I said. "We all will." With London in Atlanta, I passed most of the weekend at Marge's, just as I promised my daughter. My parents were there too, alongside Liz. We spent long hours at the kitchen table telling stories about Marge, as if our vivid memories and outrageous accounts of Marge's exploits would help keep her alive longer. I finally told my parents and Liz about the night I rescued Marge from the water tower. Liz recreated the romantic scavenger hunt. We laughed about Marge's roller skating and horror movie obsessions, and reminisced about the idyllic day that Marge and Liz had spent with Emily and me at the Biltmore estate. We marveled at Marge's wit, and the fact that she still viewed me as a little brother desperately in need of her superior guidance. I wished Marge had been there to hear all the stories, but she was with us for only a few of them. The rest of the time, she was sleeping. On Sunday evening, London returned from Atlanta. Vivian said goodbye to our daughter near the limo and didn't come inside. It was the last day of January. Marge and I were both born in the month of March, she on the 4th and I on the 12th. We were both Pisces, and in the world of the Zodiac, people born under that sign are said to be compassionate and devoted. I'd always believed that to be truer of Marge than me. Her birthday, I realized, was less than 5 weeks away, and I knew she wouldn't be around to celebrate it. Like Marge, I just knew.
Chapter 26.
saying goodbye. My parents didn't have the most active social lives when Marge and I were young. While my dad might grab a beer every now and then with friends, it was relatively rare, and my mom hardly went out at all. Between work, cooking, cleaning, visiting her family, and raising kids, she didn't have a lot of extra free time. Nor did my parents dine out as a couple very often. Dining out was considered an extravagance, something I can remember them doing perhaps half a dozen times. When you consider birthdays, anniversaries, Valentine's Day, Mother's Day, and Father's Day, 6 dinner dates in 18 years isn't much. That meant that when they did go out, Marge and I would be giddy at the thought of having the house to ourselves. As soon as their car pulled out of the driveway, we'd make popcorn or s'mores, or both, and start watching movies with the volume turned up way too loud until, inevitably, one of Marge's friends would call. Once she got on the phone, I would suddenly be forgotten, but I was usually okay with that, since it meant even more s'mores for me. Once, when she was 13 or so, she convinced me that we should build a fort in the living room. We found a coil of clothesline in the storage shed and ran it from the curtain rod to the grandfather clock to an air vent and back again to the curtain rod. We pulled towels and sheets from the linen closet, fastening them to the line with clothespins. Another sheet went over the top, and we finished the fort with pillows pulled from the couch. Marge hauled in a propane-fueled camping lantern from the garage. We somehow got that lit without burning down the house. My dad would have been furious had he known. And Marge turned out all the lights before we crawled inside. Setting the whole thing up had taken more than an hour, and it would take almost as long to take it all down and clean up, which meant we were only able to spend 15 or 20 minutes in the fort before my parents got home. Even when they did go out, they never stayed out late. I still recall that night as a near magical experience. At 8 years old, it was adventurous and new, and the fact that it was also against the rules made me feel older than I was. More like Marge's peer than a little kid for the very first time. And as I looked at my sister in the eerie glow of the lantern in our makeshift fort, I can distinctly remember thinking that Marge was not only my sister, but my best friend as well. I knew even then that nothing would ever change it. On February 1st, the high temperature hit 71 degrees. 5 days later, the high was only 50 degrees and the low dipped to 24. The wild temperature swings that first week of February seemed to weaken Marge even further. With every passing day, Marge grew worse. Her 16 hours of sleep a day lengthened to 19 hours, and every breath was a struggle. The paralysis on her right side grew even more pronounced, and we rented a wheelchair to move her around the house more easily. Her words started to slur, and she had hardly any appetite, but those things were nothing compared to the pain she was experiencing. My sister was taking so many painkillers that I suspected that her liver was turning to mush, but the only time she seemed to feel any relief was when she slept. Not that Marge ever mentioned the pain. Not to my parents or Liz, and not to me. As always, she was more worried about others than herself, but her suffering was evident in the way she winced, and the way her eyes would unexpectedly blur with tears. Witnessing her agony was torture for us all. Often I would sit with her in the living room as she slept on the couch. Other times I sat in the rocking chair in the bedroom. As I stared at her sleeping form, memories would roll back through the years, like a movie playing in reverse. A movie in which Marge was the star with the most memorable lines of all. She was forever vivid, forever alive, and I wondered whether my memories would remain that way, or whether they would slowly fade with the passage of time. I struggled mightily to see past her illness, telling myself that I owed it to her to remember everything about the way she was before she got sick. On the day that the temperature plunged to 24 degrees, I remembered something that my father had told me about wood frogs, which can be found in North Carolina to as far north as the Arctic Circle. As cold-blooded creatures, wood frogs were susceptible to frigid temperatures and could freeze completely solid to the point that their hearts stopped completely. And yet, the frog has evolved in such a way that glycogen continues to break down into glucose, which acts a bit like nature's antifreeze. They can remain frozen and immobilized for weeks, but when the weather finally begins to warm, the wood frog blinks, and the heart starts back up. There's a quick breath, and the frog hops away in search of its mate, as if God had merely hit the pause button. Watching my sister sleep, I found myself wishing for a miracle of nature. Just like that. Strangely, the rest of my life continued to move forward apace. Work remained a sometimes welcome distraction, and my clients' enthusiasm for my work product was a rare bright spot during that time. I met with my realtor and signed on the dotted line. The couple from Louisville asked for a long escrow, because they wanted their kids to finish out the school year there, so the closing was set for May. And over lunch one day, Emily casually asked me for the name of my realtor, revealing that she was thinking of selling her house too.
"I think I need a fresh start," she said, "in a place where I didn't live with David."
At the time, I suspected she was just trying to show moral support for my own decision to sell, a decision she knew I still harbored ambivalence about. But a few days later, she texted me a photo of the new for sale sign in her front yard. Nothing remains the same for long. Her life, like mine, was moving forward. I just wished I knew where mine was heading. My dad continued to show up at Marge's house with his toolbox nearly every afternoon. What began as necessary repairs on the house gradually turned into extensive remodeling. He had torn out the entirety of the guest bathroom on the day Liz and Marge attended my open house, intent on upgrading it to the kind of bathroom he thought his only daughter deserved. My dad was a dinosaur when it came to technology. To that point in his life, he'd seen no reason to purchase a cell phone. His boss always knew the location of the job site, and everyone else on the crew had one, so he could always be contacted. Who else would call him anyway, he wondered. Why be bothered? Yet my dad came to me right after the new year and asked me to help him buy a phone. Since he didn't know anything about those cellular gadgets, he asked me to select one for him. "Just make sure it does all that fancy stuff," he said, "but isn't too expensive." Though my dad hadn't mentioned it, I chose a phone that I felt would be simple for him to use as well. I set him up on my plan, and then spent some time with him showing him how to make and receive calls, as well as text. To his contacts, I added the information for Marge, Liz, my mom, and me. I couldn't think of anyone else to add. "Can it take pictures?" he asked. "I've seen phones that can do that now." Pretty much all phones have done that for years, I thought to myself. But I said only, "Yes, it does." I showed him that function and watched as he practiced taking pictures and then examining them. I also showed him how to delete the ones he didn't want. Though I had the sense that much of the information was overwhelming, I watched him carefully tuck the phone into his pocket and head out to his car. I saw him again at Marge's house the following day. She'd risen from her nap and our mom had chicken soup waiting. Marge ate half the bowl, less than we'd hoped, and when the tray was taken away, our dad took a seat beside her. He looked almost shy as he began to show her photos of various faucets, sinks, and towel rods, as well as options for floor and wall tile. Obviously, he'd been at the home improvement store, and this was the only way he could make sure that Marge was part of the design process. Marge knew that our dad had never been a man of words, nor had he ever been openly affectionate. But through his labors, she could see that in his own way he was shouting his love for her at the top of his lungs, hoping that she could somehow hear what he'd always found so difficult to say. Dad took notes as she made her selections, and when they were finished, Marge leaned closer to him, giving him no choice but to hug her. "Love you, Daddy," she whispered. Then, rising from the couch, he lumbered out of the house. Everyone knew he was off to purchase her selections, but after a few minutes I realized that I hadn't heard him start his car. When I got up to peek through the curtains at the driveway, I saw my dad, the strongest man I'd ever known, sitting in the front seat of his car with his head bowed and shoulders heaving. Wonderful aromas always floated from Marge's kitchen these days, as my mom tried desperately to make food that would tempt Marge into eating more. There were soups and stews and sauces and pasta, banana cream and lemon meringue pies, and homemade vanilla ice cream. The refrigerator and freezer were stuffed, and every time I came by, she handed me food from my refrigerator, which had gradually filled as well. Whenever Marge was awake, my mom would set a tray in front of her. By the second week of February, my mom had begun to feed her because her left side was growing weaker as well. She would carefully raise the spoon to her lips, wiping her mouth between bites, and then offer my sister a sip of something to drink through a straw. While Marge ate, my mom would talk. She would talk about Dad and the way the young new owner of the plumbing business was giving Dad a hard time for missing so much work. By that time, my dad had probably accrued years of vacation time, but the owner was the kind of guy who was never happy, a man who demanded more from the employees while demanding less of himself. She described the tulips she'd planted for my dad, and the lecture she'd attended with her Red Hat Society friends. She also regaled Marge with things that London had told her, no matter how inconsequential. More than once I heard my mom pretend to be upset that no one had notified her in advance about Marge's and London's roller skating adventure.
I picked you up and dropped you off so many times at that rink that my tires made tire grooves in the parking lot asphalt. And you forgot to mention when my granddaughter was trying it for the very first time?
I knew that she was only half teasing, that she would have loved to have been there, and I silently berated myself for it. My mom, after all, not only wanted to see London on skates that day, she'd wanted to see her own daughter, skating with abandon and joy on her face. One last time. As the second week of February rolled around, I had the sensation that time was simultaneously speeding up and slowing down. There was a slow-motion quality to the hours I spent at Marge's every day, marked by long stretches of silence and sleep. On the other hand, each time I showed up, it seemed that Marge's deterioration was accelerating. One afternoon before pickup, I stopped by and found her awake in the living room. She and Liz were speaking in low voices, so I offered to leave, but Liz shook her head.
"Stay," Liz said. "I was about to touch base with one of my clients anyway. It's an emergency. You two talk for a bit. I'm hoping this won't take long."
I took a seat by my sister. I didn't ask her how she was feeling because I knew it was a question she hated. Instead, as always, she asked about Emily and work, London and Vivian, her voice slurred and tinny. Because she tired so easily, I did most of the talking. Toward the end, though, I asked if I could ask her a question.
"Of course," she said, her syllables running together. "I wrote you a letter for Christmas, but I never heard what you thought about it."
She smiled her half-smile, the one I'd grown used to.
"I haven't read it yet."
"Why not?"
"Because," she said, "I'm not ready to say goodbye to you just yet."
I confess that I sometimes wondered if she'd ever have a chance to read it. Over the next 3 days, whenever I went to the house, Marge was always asleep, usually in her bedroom. I would stay for an hour or two, visiting with Liz or my mom, whoever happened to be around. I would admire the latest repairs or renovations that my dad had undertaken, and more often than not eat a large plate of food that my mom would put down in front of me. We almost always stayed in the kitchen. I thought at first it was because no one wanted to disturb Marge while she was sleeping, but I discounted that when I realized that if my dad's hammering wasn't enough to wake her, our low voices wouldn't either. I finally figured it out one afternoon, when Liz stepped outside to sweep the porch. At loose ends, I wandered to the living room and took a seat in the spot where Marge and I usually sat. My dad was working away quietly in the bathroom, but I realized I could hear a strange rhythmic sound, like a malfunctioning fan or vent. Unable to pinpoint its origin, I moved first to the kitchen and then to the bathroom, where I spotted my dad lying on his back with his head beneath the new sink, in the final stages of hooking it up. But the sound was fainter in both those places. It grew in volume only as I began to make my way down the hallway, and it was then that I knew what was making that horrible noise. It was my sister. Despite the closed door, across the far reaches of the house, what I'd been hearing was the sound of my sister breathing. Valentine's Day fell on a Sunday that year. Marge had planned a special gathering at her house, even inviting Emily and Bodie, and I brought London over as soon as she got back from Atlanta. For the first time in 2 weeks, London and I arrived to find Marge sitting upright on the couch. Someone, maybe my mom, maybe Liz, had helped her apply a little makeup. Instead of the baseball cap, Marge wore a gorgeous silk scarf, and a thick turtleneck sweater helped disguise the weight she'd lost. Despite the tumor ravaging her brain, she was able to follow the conversation, and I even heard her laugh once or twice. There were moments when it almost felt like one of our usual Saturday or Sunday afternoons at our parents'. Almost. The house itself had never looked better. My dad had finished the guest bathroom and the new tiles and sink gleamed, reflecting state-of-the-art fixtures. He'd also spent the last week repainting all of the interior trim in the house. My mom had laid out a veritable banquet on every surface of the kitchen, and as soon as Emily arrived, my mom made her promise to take a mountain of leftovers home with her, including whatever was left of the pies.
We rehashed a lot of family stories, but the highlight of the evening was when Liz presented her Valentine's Day gift to Marge. She'd made a photo album of the two of them that opened with photos of each of them as infants and progressed through their entire lives. On the left-hand pages were photos of Liz, on the right, Marge. I knew that my mom must have helped Liz compile the photos, and as Marge slowly turned the pages, I watched my sister and Liz grow up in tandem before my eyes. Eventually, the album began to feature photos of the two of them together, some taken on exotic trips, while others were merely candid shots taken around the house. No matter how formal or casual, however, each photo seemed chosen to tell a story about a particularly meaningful moment in their lives together. The entire album was a testament to their love, and I found myself close to tears. It was the final two pages of the album that broke me. On the left was the photo of Marge and Liz beneath the Rockefeller Center Christmas tree in New York, the last trip they would ever take together. On the right was a photo that looked to have been taken only a couple of hours earlier, with Marge looking exactly as she did right then. Liz explained that my dad had taken it, and that unbeknownst to her had left to get it developed at a nearby drugstore. Upon his return, he asked Liz to add it to the last page of the album. All eyes turned toward him. "I've always been so proud of you," my dad choked out as he looked at Marge. "And I want you to know that I love you too." The day after Valentine's Day, the waiting began. I now believe that on Valentine's Day, Marge used much of her last remaining reserves of energy. She slept almost the entire day Monday and ate no solid food from that point on, sipping only tepid chicken broth through a straw. While my mom and dad were a constant presence at Marge's house, I drifted in and out, mainly because of London. She had been unusually volatile since learning the truth about Marge, occasionally throwing a tantrum or bursting into tears over trivial things. She would get particularly emotional when I refused her requests to visit Marge, but it was difficult to explain to London that her aunt was almost always sleeping now. However, a few days following the Valentine's Day celebration, Liz called me at home in the evening. "Can you bring London by?" she said urgently. "Marge wants to see her." I called up to London, who was already upstairs in her pajamas, her hair still wet from her bath. She raced down the stairs and would have rushed straight to the car, but I managed to block the door in order to get her to put on a jacket. When I pointed out that she wasn't wearing shoes, she randomly grabbed a pair of rubber boots from the closet and slipped those on, despite the fact that it wasn't raining. I saw she was holding a Barbie, refusing to put it down even while donning her coat. When we arrived at Marge's house, Liz gave London a hug and kiss, and immediately pointed her in the direction of the master bedroom. Despite her fevered rush to the car, London hesitated for a moment before starting slowly down the hall. I trailed a few steps behind. Again, I could hear my sister, the sound of life leaving her with every breath she took. Inside her room, the bedstand lamp spilled a warm pool of light onto the hardwood floor. London paused just inside the doorway.
"Hi, honey," Marge said to her, the words slurred but understandable.
London cautiously approached the bed, moving quietly so as not to disturb her sick aunt. I leaned against the door jamb, watching as London reached Marge's side.
"What do you have there?" Marge asked.
"I brought you a present,"
London responded, handing over the doll she'd been clutching all along.
"It's my favorite Barbie because I've had her since I was little. She's my first Barbie, and I want you to have it."
When London realized that Marge didn't have the strength to take it, she set it beside Marge, propping it against my sister as she lay beneath the covers.
"Thank you. She's pretty, but you're prettier."
London bowed her head and raised it again.
"I love you, Auntie Marge. I love you so much. I don't want you to die."
"I know. And I love you, too. But I have something for you. Auntie Liz put it on the dresser. One day, when you're old enough, maybe you can watch it with your dad, okay? And maybe, when you do, you'll think about me. Can you promise me you'll do that? I promise."
My eyes flashed to the dresser. I saw the DVD that Marge had given my daughter, and I blinked back sudden tears as I saw the title. Pretty Woman.
Marge thinks I should still have a baby, Liz told me over coffee in the kitchen a few days later.
Her expression was a mixture of fatigue and bewilderment. When did she tell you this?
Well, she first brought it up when we went to New York, she said. She keeps pointing out that I'm healthy enough to do it, but
she trailed off. I waited for her to go on, but she seemed lost. Do you want to do that? I asked in a tentative voice.
I don't know, Russ. It's all just so hard to contemplate right now. I can't imagine doing it on my own, but she brought it up again yesterday.
For a moment she picked at the grain of the kitchen table, making a small groove in the wood.
She told me that she'd already made financial arrangements in case I felt differently down the road. That I'd be able to afford IVF, a nanny if I wanted, schooling even.
When I tilted my head trying to figure how and when Marge had made these arrangements, Liz ran a hand over her hair, trying to corral loose strands into her messy ponytail.
Apparently, right after she'd passed the CPA and became an accountant, she bought a bunch of life insurance. Two different policies, in fact. She added to them over the years, and it's quite a lot of money. The larger policy lists me as the beneficiary, and it's more than I'll ever need, even if I did decide to have a child on my own. She recently changed the beneficiary on the other policy to your parents, so your dad can retire. I asked about you.
I raised my hand, interrupting. I'm glad it's going to you and my parents, I said. She looked confused, as if none of the information she'd recited really made sense to her.
What I kept wondering when she told me about all this, Liz continued, is how did she know?
I asked her, and she said that because of her family history, and even though she wasn't sure who the beneficiaries would eventually be, early on, I think she listed you and your parents, she wanted to make sure she had it just in case she ever needed it. She never told me.
She never told me either, Liz admitted. When we were discussing having a baby before she got sick, I guess I never really focused on the cost.
We do okay, and we've saved a bit, but mostly I guess I always trusted that if Marge thought we could afford it, we could. For a moment, her expression verged on desperation.
I could barely hold myself together. I told her that I didn't think I was capable of raising a child without her. She was always the more maternal one. And do you know what she said to that?
I looked at her, waiting.
She said that I was her inspiration and that any child that I raised would make the world a better place. And that if there's a heaven, she promised that she would watch over our child forever.
The following day, it was my turn to say goodbye. When I arrived at the house, Marge was sleeping, as usual. I stayed for a while, keeping an eye on the clock so as not to be late to pick up London from school. But before long, the baby monitor in the kitchen crackled, and both my mom and Liz hustled back to the bedroom. A few minutes later, my mom returned to the kitchen.
Marge wants to see you, she said.
How is she?
She seems pretty coherent, but you should probably head back now. Sometimes she starts to get confused and doesn't stay awake long.
Observing my mom's steady demeanor, I could see that she was every bit as strong as my father, for she was bearing the unbearable, each and every day. I held my mom for a moment, then walked down the hall to the bedroom. As on Valentine's Day, Marge was wearing a pretty scarf, and I guessed that she had asked Liz to put it on her before I came in. I pulled a chair from the corner of the room and scooted it toward the bed. Liz backed out of the room as I reached for my sister's hand. It felt warm, but lifeless in mine. Unmoving. I didn't know whether she could even feel it, but I squeezed it anyway.
Hi, sis, I said to her softly.
At my voice, she blinked, then struggled to clear her throat.
Read,
she said, the word coming out garbled. It took a moment for me to understand what she meant, but then I spotted the envelope that Liz had placed on the bedstand, and I reached for it. Opening it, I pulled out the single sheet of paper, took a deep breath, and began to read. Marge, it's late at night, and I am struggling to find the words that I wish would come more easily. In truth, I'm not sure it's even possible to convey in words how much you've always meant to me. I could tell you that I love you, and that you're the greatest sister a guy could ever have. I could admit that I've always looked up to you. And yet, because I've said those things to you before, it feels painfully inadequate. How can I say goodbye to the best person I've ever known, in a way she truly deserves. And then it occurred to me that all of what I need to say can be summed up in just two words. Thank you. Thank you for looking out for me all my life, for trying to protect me from my own mistakes, for being a living example of the courage I so desperately wish I owned. But most of all, thank you for showing me what it means to truly love and be loved in return. You know me, the maestro of grand romantic gestures, of candlelit dinners and flowers on date night. But what I didn't understand until recently was that those tender, orchestrated moments mean nothing unless they occur with someone who loves you just the way you are. For too long, I was in a relationship in which love always felt conditional. I was forever trying and failing to become someone worthy of true love. But in thinking about you and Liz and the way you are with each other, it eventually dawned on me that acceptance is the heart of true love, not judgment. To be fully accepted by another, even in your weakest moment, is to finally feel at rest. You and Liz are my heroes and my muses, because your love for each other has always made room for your differences and celebrated everything you had in common. And in these darkest hours, your example has been a light that helped me find my way back to the things that matter most. I only pray that someday I, too, will know the kind of love that you two share. I love you, my sweet sister. Russ. My hand shook as I refolded the letter and placed it back in the envelope. I didn't trust myself to speak, but Marge's wise gaze told me I didn't need to.
Emily, she wheezed, you have that with her.
I love her, I agreed.
Don't let her go.
I won't.
And don't cheat on her again.
And here she managed the ghost of a wicked smile.
Or at least don't tell her.
I couldn't help but laugh. My sister, even at death's doorstep, hadn't changed a bit. I won't. It took her a little bit to catch her breath.
Mom and Dad need to see London, be part of her life.
They always will be, just like Liz.
Worried for them.
I thought of my mom and all the loved ones she lost. I thought of my dad, weeping in the car.
Do it.
I will. I promise.
Love you.
I squeezed my sister's hand, then leaned down and kissed her on the cheek. I love you more than you will ever know, I said. After offering a tender smile, she closed her eyes. It was the last time I ever spoke to her. My dad packed up his tool chest that night, and all of us kissed Liz goodbye. Now it was time for the two of them to be alone. I don't know what, if anything, they said to each other over the next couple of days. Liz never told us, other than to say that Marge enjoyed a day of surprising lucidity before she finally slipped into a coma. I am glad that Liz was there for that, and I pray that they both had a chance to say most of what was left to be said. A day later, my sister died. The funeral at the gravesite was a short affair. Marge had apparently given strict instructions to that effect, but the brief ceremony attracted dozens of mourners, all of them bundled up under the cold and gloomy sky. I gave an abbreviated eulogy, of which I have little memory, other than that I spotted Vivian standing at the edge of the crowd, far from my family, Liz, and Emily. Prior to the funeral, London had asked if she could dance for her auntie one last time. So after the mourners had dispersed, streaming away to their cars, I helped London attach her gauzy wings. With no music and only me as an audience, London fluttered gracefully around the freshly turned earth, like a butterfly flitting in and out of the shadows. This much I know. Marge would have loved it. Epilogue. At the park, I sit in the shade while London runs and climbs and plays on the swing. It's been hot the last couple of weeks, and the air is so thick with humidity that I keep spare t-shirts in the trunk of my car to change into at times like this. They don't stay dry for long, but I suppose that's typical for late July. In the past 4 months, the Phoenix Agency has signed 3 more legal firms as clients, and now represents firms in 3 different states. I've had to find a new office, and 2 months ago I hired my first employees. Mark had 2 years' experience with an internet marketing firm in Atlanta, and Tamara is a recent graduate from Clemson with a degree in film. Both of them are digital natives and text using both their thumbs, as opposed to the hunt-and-peck method preferred by their boss. They're intelligent and eager to learn, and they've made it possible for me to spend time with London this summer. Like last summer, my daughter is constantly on the go. Tennis, piano, and art, along with dance at a different studio, one run by an instructor who inspires hugs from the kids. I drive her to and from her activities, and work while she's busy. In the afternoons, we can often be found at the neighborhood pool or at the park, depending on her mood. It amazes me to see how much she's changed since our first summer together. She's taller and more confident, and when I'm driving her here and there, I can often hear her sounding out the words she sees on billboards. My house isn't as large as my former home, but it's comfortable, and both of Emily's paintings, the one I had bought at the show and the one she'd painted of London and me, grace the walls of the living room. Even though I've been living there since late May, there are still boxes I haven't yet unpacked, and I had to rent a storage unit for the furniture from my previous home that I no longer needed. I'll probably sell most of it eventually, but with all the recent changes in my life, I just haven't had the time. I'm still getting used to living in Atlanta, after all. Vivian and I met the day after the funeral, and in less than an hour we had worked everything out. Though I offered, she declined my offer of alimony, and as for the property settlement, she asked for only half of the equity in the house, savings, and investment accounts. She let me keep the funds in our joint retirement account, but then again, money for her was no longer the concern it once was. At that same meeting, she revealed that she was secretly engaged to Spannerman. Others would learn of it after our divorce was finalized, and while I could have been hurt by that, I found to my surprise that it didn't bother me at all. I was in love with Emily, and like Vivian, I'd reached the point where I was ready for a new chapter in my life. However, money had never been the real bone of contention between us. Custody was. So I was both relieved and a bit skeptical when she leaned over and said in an earnest voice, "I want to apologize for the letter my attorney sent." She placed a hand over her heart. I was venting in her office and didn't realize how my words would get twisted. "I know you would never do anything inappropriate with London, and when I finally saw the letter my attorney had sent, I felt sick to my stomach." She sighed. "I can't imagine what you must have been thinking about me." She closed her eyes, and in the moment I chose to believe her. Part of me longed for that. I didn't want to think she had ever been capable of such things, but the truth is, I'll never know how things actually transpired. "When Marge asked to see me that night, she told me flat out that London needed both of us, that I would be hurting London by pursuing sole custody. Needless to say, I was angry. At the time, I felt it was none of her business, but her words affected me more than I wanted to admit, and over time I began to realize that she might be right." On her wrist, she twisted a thin gold bracelet around and around. "Whenever London came to Atlanta, all she did was talk about you. How much fun she had with you, the games you played together, the places you went." Her voice trembled. "I never wanted to take London from you. I just wanted her with me. So when Marge said you would move to Atlanta, I was floored. I never imagined that you'd leave Charlotte or your parents. I always felt that you started your own business because you weren't serious about finding work in another city." At my protest, she held up a hand. "That's why I wanted sole custody in the first place. Because I love London too, and only seeing her every other weekend was killing me. I guess I never believed that you would go to such lengths to remain in her life." She looked directly at me. "You're a great father, Russ. I know that now. If you're willing to move to Atlanta like Marge said,
and you want to split time with London, I think we can probably figure something out.
Which is exactly what we did. For starters, London was allowed to stay with me and Charlotte to finish out the school year. 2 days later, the moving van filled with our stuff rolled toward Atlanta. When Vivian travels, which is often 3 or 4 nights a week, London stays with me. I also have my daughter every other weekend, and London and I have a standing date night on those Fridays she's with me. To avoid a repeat of the past year, Vivian and I have decided to alternate holidays in the future. So I can still read bedtime stories to my daughter when she stays with her mom, I bought a mini iPad, and London props it against a pillow to see me via FaceTime. Even better, once school starts, I'll get to pick her up at school every day, and she'll stay with me until Vivian finishes at work. I'm assuming that means that London and I will have dinner sometimes. Other times, London will have dinner with her mom. But I'm confident that Vivian and I will figure it out. I find myself being thankful to Vivian for all those things, cognizant that in all the years I've known her, my ex-wife has never once failed to surprise me. Even, sometimes, in good ways. I dreaded telling Emily that I was moving. Most people would applaud my decision to choose my daughter over a new romantic relationship, but I also knew that a woman like Emily comes along once in a lifetime. Charlotte and Atlanta were close enough for a short-term relationship, but could it really work in the long run? Like me, Emily had been born and raised in Charlotte, and her parents and sister lived nearby. We hadn't been seeing each other for very long. To that point in our relationship, we hadn't so much as even kissed. "You could do better than me," is how I began the conversation. "There were smarter and kinder men, wealthier and better-looking suitors," I went on. When Emily interrupted me to ask what this was about, I spilled everything. My conversations with Marge, my meeting with Vivian the day after the funeral, the realization that I needed to move to Atlanta. For London. Could she forgive me? Standing, she put her arms around me. We were in her kitchen at the time, and in that moment, my eyes flashed to her studio, where she was working on yet another painting. It was one she intended to give Liz. As she'd done with the image of London and me, Emily was painting a version of the photo taken of Marge and Liz beneath the Rockefeller Center Christmas tree. "I've known for a while that you were going to move to Atlanta," she whispered into my ear. "Marge told me when I went to see her. Why do you think I put my house up for sale?" Emily and I now live less than a mile from each other. We're each renting for the time being because we both know that it's only a matter of time before we start shopping for rings. There are those who might think it's too fast. My divorce was finalized only 3 months ago. But to this I would respond, how many people have the chance to marry their closest friend? For London, knowing that Bodie not only lives here but will go to the same school, there's an excellent one nearby, has made London's transition that much easier. Right after I watched London zip down the slide, I glanced toward the parking lot and saw Emily pulling in. Bodie jumped out and made a beeline toward London, and when Emily smiled and waved, I knew with certainty that my day has gotten a whole lot better. And by the way, if anyone's interested, on Emily's first night in Atlanta, she moved here a week after London and I did. We celebrated with champagne and ended up in bed. Ever since, I felt as if I finally come home. It hasn't been easy for my parents, or for Liz. On the weekends that Vivian has London, I make the drive to Charlotte, and I visit my parents. Liz is often there, and our conversations drift to Marge as a matter of course. These days, we no longer weep at the mention of Marge's name, but the aching emptiness remains. I'm not certain that any of us will ever fully fill the void. Yet there are glimmers of hope. When Liz and I were chatting last weekend, she asked me in an offhanded way whether I thought she was too old to become a single mother. When I assured her to the contrary, she merely nodded. I didn't press her, but I could see that Marge's gift to Liz was already bearing the fruit of possibility. Later that same afternoon, my dad mentioned that the owner of the plumbing company was running it into the ground, and he wasn't sure whether he wanted to stick around to watch that happen. When my parents came to visit London and me in Atlanta earlier this week, I caught my mom looking through the real estate section of the newspaper. As I mentioned before, my sister always had a plan. As for me, Marge had known all along what I needed to do, and in the weeks following her funeral, I often wondered why she hadn't simply told me to move to Atlanta, instead of letting me fumble my way to the answer on my own. Only recently did I figure out why she'd held back. That after a lifetime of looking to her for guidance, she knew I needed to learn to trust my own judgment. She knew that her little brother needed just one more push to become the man she always knew I could be. The man who finally had the confidence to act when it mattered most. It was a year to remember and a year to forget, and I am not the man I was 12 months ago. In the end, I lost too much. The grief I feel about Marge is still too fresh. I will miss her always and know that I couldn't have weathered the past year without her. Nor can I imagine who I'd be today without London. And whenever I look at Emily, I clearly envision a future with her at my side. Marge, Emily, and London supported me when I needed it most, in ways that now seem almost preordained. But here's the thing. With each of them, I was a different person. I was a brother, and a father, and a suitor. And I think to myself that these distinctions reflect one of life's universal truths. At any given time, I am not the whole me. I am but a partial version of myself, and each version is slightly different from the others. But each of these versions of me, I now believe, has always had someone by his side. I'd survived the year because I've been able to march two by two with those I love the most. And though I've never admitted it to anyone, there are moments, even now, when I feel Marge walking beside me. I'll hear her whisper the answer when I'm confronted with a decision. I'll hear her urging me to lighten up when the world is weighing heavily on me. This is my secret. Or rather, it is our secret. And I think to myself that I've been lucky, for no one should ever be forced to march through life alone. This has been a Hachette audio production of 2x2, written by Nicholas Sparks, read by Ari Fliakos, music by J.D. Eicher, produced and directed by Cheryl Smith, recorded by John Muller, post-production Beat Street Productions. 2x2 is also available in print and digital formats from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2016 by Willow Holdings, Inc. Audio production copyright 2016 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.